I've been a fan of my next guest for a long time, from the two decades or more that he has spent on stages in nightclubs and theaters doing stand-up comedy, to his work directing the movie The Aristocrats a few years ago with his buddy Penn Jillette, to the new Showtime show he has called The Green Room. Paul Provenza has always been out there keeping an eye on comedy and comedians and talking to them about their craft. He's interviewed a bunch of them also in a brand new book called Satiristas, subtitled Comedians, Contrarians, Raconteurs, and Vulgarians. Paul, welcome to the Big 550 KTRS.
Thank you for having me, sir.
It's nice to have you on here today.
Happy 4th of July weekend.
Happy 4th of July to you, too. As I look through this book, and you've interviewed people from Robin Williams to Lewis Black, from David Cross to Bill Maher, Cheech and Chong, Patton Oswalt, Don Novello, Andy Borowitz, people all over the spectrum, all sorts of different kinds of comedians.
Yeah, I also went back a couple of generations, too, to the great Tom Lehrer and the Smothers Brothers.
Yes, you did. And it all leads up to a big finale with George Carlin. Is he the patron saint of satire in America?
He's kind of become the de facto, sort of the eminence grise, if you will, of comedy that speaks its mind. People who really really say what they believe, regardless of the consequences. He's sort of he's the maestro. He was amazing. At the age of 70, he was still relevant. I mean, I remember seeing him working out some material down in Hermosa Beach at the Comedy and Magic Club, great club, and sitting next to people 10 years my senior in their 60s and 15-year-olds, and everybody enjoying it and getting his points the same way. That's really hard to do in comedy.
The thing that's interested me about Carlin for a long time, and in not just in the times that I interviewed him, but in his books and his HBO stand-up shows as well, is it seemed to me that the older he got, the less he cared, which gave him the ability to be more biting. Did you notice
exactly
the same thing?
Yeah, he got more and more liberated. He got more and more truthful, and damn the consequences. He was really special, and I had the bittersweet opportunity of speaking to him just a week before he died. It's pretty much his last interview.
Yeah, really good insight into the man in this book, as well as the ones with others. But I'm curious if you saw that same thing with other comedians who, once they had gotten older and perhaps had gathered some wealth together, they started doing sharper stuff, or do you find that most of them soften up a little bit?
I generally, people do soften up a little bit. I mean, it's a function of aging. It's a function of losing that fire in your belly. That kind of comedy is generally a younger man's game, or woman's game. It's something that just takes a lot of energy that you lose as you get older, and sometimes success softens people, but certainly Bill Maher has become infinitely more successful than he ever was, and he just gets more and more fearless.
Yeah.
So there are those few exceptions, and I hope we've caught a lot of them in the book here.
I think you did. There's a lot of talk in the book, Satiristas, about the Colbert Report, by you and by many of the people you talk to.
Isn't that interesting to hear everybody almost in unison agree that what Colbert is doing is just remarkable?
What's he doing that's new and different that surprises these professional comedians?
Well, it's really a level of degree of difficulty in what Stephen does. He's a classic example of satire in the Greek sense of the word, in the Greek playwriting sense of the word, or poetry sense of the word, in that he embraces an idea that he wishes to mock or ridicule to such a degree that it becomes self-evident. And so what he's doing per se isn't innovative, it's actually quite classical. But his level of commitment and his skill and craft in, what he does on any given night, you see him in interviews with political figures or authors or journalists, and he is improvising in character, being spontaneous, maintaining an integrity to both the character and the ideas. It's just remarkably difficult to do, just from a craft and technique and talent point of view. It's remarkable to see. And really, if you think about it, nobody's really done it, and certainly in our generation.
Do you think the people he's satirizing get that he's satirizing them?
You know what? We talk about that in Satiristas, actually. And he says he's not really sure. He gives a story about having done a piece at the Democratic convention and then at the Republican convention, and how he really gets confused as to whether or not people are getting the point. Ultimately, he doesn't care because it's there for whoever does get it. And sometimes he's even confused about it, actually. It's really fascinating. I mean, a lot of the people in Satiristas, big names and unknowns, they really open up and talk very intimately about what they do and question themselves, too, which is a rare thing, I think.
In the discussions you have about Colbert, there's also a regular mention of his appearance at the White House Correspondents Association dinner a few years ago when President Bush was still on the dais. And Colbert, in character, as you point out, was going after the administration that was sitting 8 feet away from him. I have two questions for you about that. One, was that incredibly bold? And two, as a comedian, how hard is it to make fun of somebody sitting 8 feet away from you?
Well, for the first question, I and everybody else but Stephen Colbert thinks it was incredibly brave. Interestingly, his perspective is that he was so confident in the comedy that it didn't even dawn on him that it was something to be afraid of, which is just perfect, really, that, he's doing something fearless but doesn't even think of it as being fearless. And everybody else sees it and goes, wow, what a pair on that guy.
Yeah.
In terms of how difficult that is to do, there's a lot of factors involved, not the least of which is that we are professionals and we do have a job to do and we're hired by somebody. And, what you don't want to do is alienate the person that embraced you and has given you a big fat paycheck.
Right.
So there are those sort of professional and personal concerns as well as the creative ones. He didn't set out to alienate anybody, but interestingly, the next year they chose Rich Little. Went completely in the opposite direction as far as you can go in terms of possible offense or seriousness.
Right. It's one thing if you're doing a Raw, a Jeffrey Ross kind of roast routine for somebody who knows that they're there to be roasted. But at the White House Correspondents Association, there's gentle jabs at the president usually, but Colbert was sticking the knife in and turning it.
It was such a remarkable thing to have happen. I mean, like, one of the things I asked him was, the guy that booked you, did he get it? And he said, I don't know. did he understand that he was letting a fox into the hen house like this?
Yeah.
Or what? But, I think whoever that guy was, his tax returns better be impeccable for the last 20 years.
Talking with Paul Provenza about his book Satiristas here on the Big 550 KTRS. Another ongoing theme in the book with many of the comics that you talk to is the question of, can satire change anything? What do you think?
Well, I'll tell you, just from my own personal experience, the answer is yes, because I have been changed by a satire or political comedy, or socially conscious comedy, comedy that presents points. Carlin never was not a satire in the truest, most literal sense of the word, but in the colloquial sense of the word, which is, a comedy with a point and comedy with a social meaning behind it. And I've been altered by it. I mean, when I discovered Carlin as a young teenager, it changed my entire worldview. I was just like, wow, boy, you really can go to these places that everybody says is wrong. And you know what? Maybe I'm not crazy,
Yeah.
So I know from personal experience that, yes, it can. It may not affect people. It may not affect society or policy, but it definitely affects individuals. And in fact, Carlin even talks about that at the end of his interview. He says, no matter how many old sweaters I send to Darfur, I'll never have the impact that I'll have on some kid listening to something in his bedroom when he's 12 years old.
For many of those kids, and I was one of them, just as you were, growing up with Klein and Carlin and Pryor, you heard these guys saying things that maybe you had thought, but now here was a guy saying it on TV or in a nightclub or a theater stage, and you go, what a revelation.
Yeah, that's one of the hopeful outcomes of the book, is that when people read it, it inspires them to really be confident in their points of view, and just to think about speaking their minds a little more. Because, we live in a world where, every time if you're out with friends at a bar and just having a good time and you get into a political discussion or a conversation about something meaningful and you begin to get passionate about it, somebody will always do that dopey sitcom ready line, hey, tell us what you really feel, and that is the most vile thing, I think. Because it just points to how passion has been minimized in our culture these days, that if you're really passionate and you really care about something, everybody else, you know, wants to be cynical about it. And that's one of the things about the book that I think is inspiring. Everybody in the book is somebody who speaks their mind, who are, as one critic said, these are people who take the path of most resistance. And, you know, there's something really powerful and beautiful about that, and very empowering to read about it and see all these people who also came from really tough backgrounds or had really, you know, difficult journeys, personal journeys, as well as, you know, creative journeys, all coming out on the other side and turning that into their currency.
You know, when we talk about some of these comedians who don't really care as long as they are there to make somebody laugh and they get paid for it, sometimes they're preaching to the choir, but you also have people in the audience who are going to be sensitive about it, particularly for political reasons, and that's not just people who are on the right. Don't you find sometimes that people who are extremists on the left can also be overly sensitive to satire?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, one of the interesting things that emerges in the book is that there's almost a consensus that the left, the liberal left, is almost more profoundly responsible for real censorship in this country than what you would think would be coming from the left.
Really?
I mean, I'm sorry, coming from the right. It's a very interesting thing, and that actually plays into that whole thing about speaking your mind. You know, because one of the things one of the reasons I think that we're so inculcated to not speak our minds when we feel strongly about something is because it's just, you know, you don't want to create trouble. You don't want to cause an argument. You know, it's gotten to the point now where if you create an argument in your workplace, in many cases, it's actionable. You know, it's just a very, very strange place for a democracy and a place that prides itself on freedom to be.
Is that what we've classically referred to as political correctness?
Among other things, just the idea of making trouble. Just, you know, why are you making something difficult? Why are you getting into a conflict over an abstract concept? You know, well, this entire country is an abstract concept, you know, and it's the most patriotic of us that will engage in those conflicts.
Why don't we have more overtly conservative comedians?
Well, you know, that's a very, very interesting question. You know, people often speak of Dennis Miller in that context.
I said comedian.
Dennis Miller certainly is funny, no matter what it is that he's talking about, no matter whether you agree or disagree, he's certainly funny. But there are very, very few. You're right. And when we started talking to these people who do this kind of comedy, at first we thought, you know, we want to balance it out between left and right. But what we realized was that's sort of a waste of an effort because there really is no left or right. I mean, there are people who tend to be more progressive or more liberal, but nobody really plays along party lines. Everybody's an independent thinker. And as far as conservative comedians go, I think it has something to do with the fact that comedy really, comedy that's socially conscious is generally about taking the people with power to task, not the people who suffer from that power.
Yep.
And I think when you're talking about doing right-wing, conservative, politically conservative humor, you're really talking about maintaining the status quo and the people who are not fighting the power, who already have the power, being celebrated. So I think there's a fundamental aspect to that is about poetry and literature and art more so than it is about politics.
I got to go back to Dennis Miller for just a second because I cracked when you said Dennis Miller, there's a comedian who, and I actually said comedian. I don't even think of Dennis Miller as a comedian anymore for one simple reason. And it's not a matter of his point of view anymore. It's the simple fact that he now takes himself way too seriously.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, you know, I actually did his radio show talking about the book and the Green Room. First and foremost, he considers himself a comedian. I mean, he overlooked all the challenges to his point of view to really talk about the comedy and the art form. So I think that we're just not getting to see that side of him very much anymore. And, you know, I can't argue with you. I really can't because, I'm conflicted about Dennis and what he does these days. You know, I feel like comedy that supports the kind of power that a lot of people end up suffering a great deal from is, it's questionable just on the face of it. So I can't really argue your point, but I will say that he is definitely a comedian through and through.
Paul Provenza's book is called Satiristas, Comedians, Contrarians, Raconteurs, and Vulgarians. When we come back, I'm going to ask him why Jay Leno is in this book and how difficult it is to really do satire on TV for stand-up comedians. I'm Paul Harris. This is the John Brown Show on the Big 550 KTRS.
You can't take 3 from 2. 2 is less than 3, so you look at the 4 in the tens place. Now that's really 4 tens, so you make it 3 tens, regroup, and you change a 10 to 10 ones, and you add them to the 2 and get 12, and you take away 3, that's 9. Is that clear? Now instead of 4 in the tens place, you've got 3 because you added 1, that is to say 10 to the 2, but you can't take 7 from 3, so you look in the hundreds place. From the 3, you then use 1 to make 10 ones, and you know why 4 plus minus 1 plus 10 is 14 minus 1, because addition is commutative, right? And so you got 13 tens, and you take away 7, and that leaves 5. Well, 6, actually, but... the idea is the important thing. Now go back to the hundreds place. You're left with 2, and you take away 1 from 2, and that leaves... Everybody get 1? Not bad for the first day. Hooray for new math! New math! It won't do you a bit of good to review math. It's so simple, so very simple, that only a child can do it.
That was the brilliant satirist Tom Lehrer from an album called That Was the Week That Was some 50 years ago. And nowadays, when you hear song parodies, they tend not to be nearly as biting as the stuff that Tom Lehrer was recording half a century ago. Tom Lehrer, one of the many comedians interviewed by Paul Provenza for a terrific new book called Satiristas, Comedians, Contrarians, Raconteurs, and Vulgarians. You share my view of Mr. Lehrer?
Absolutely. In fact, it was very exciting to get in touch with him. And, you know, he hasn't done a public interview in almost 20, 25 years. When he retired, and now he teaches math at Harvard and at UC Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
And spent 6 months in both those places. And when I finally reached him on an office phone, and I told him who I was, it turned out that he was a real fan of the Aristocrats and gave me an interview. And I was blown away. I was thrilled. I didn't think we'd get him. Because he really, really, truly walked away from it.
He did not.
He is incredible. I mean, his entire professional life as a performer was only about 2 years, 2.5 years long.
Yeah.
And still, 50 years later, there are people who talk about his work.
Yeah, I play that for my daughter when, you know, she was 8 or 9 years old, and, you know, she may have not known who Wernher von Braun was, but she loved the songs and the brilliance of his wit.
Yeah, he was really remarkable, and gives a great, great interview in Satiristas. And by the way, to refer to the pieces in Satiristas as interviews, I think it's a bit of a disservice, because it's not journalistic by any stretch of the imagination. What it really is comedian to comedian, the conversation.
Absolutely.
And I took excerpts from the conversations that contextually with everybody else's kind of revealed something or brought something new to the bigger picture.
All right, as I mentioned.
So he was delightful. I mean, you know, his attitude about music in satire and how, you know, it's really a fine line because you can get a lot of people cheering and stamping their feet and clapping their hands along with your point of view. He said, but that's also what they did in the beer gardens in Germany. You know, it's so interesting.
Now, the book is called Satiristas. I mentioned the subtitle is Comedians, Contrarians, Raconteurs, and Vulgarians. You interview all sorts of people here, most of whom have a pretty biting sense of humor. You include in the book Jay Leno, who certainly qualifies as a comedian, but no one would call him a contrarian, a raconteur, or a vulgarian. Why is he included in this book?
Precisely for that reason. You know, Jay Leno is perhaps the biggest comedian in America. He has one of the largest platforms for any comedian in America. He does a monologue every single night about current events, and he has chosen not to be to take any stands or voice any real opinions on issues. And that is an interesting voice. I thought it'd be really interesting to find out why he chose to do the exact opposite of everybody else in the book, given, you know, the place that he's at and the fact that he does a monologue every single night about current events.
As a comedian yourself, Paul, do you wish that he had more of an attitude or point of view?
Well, I do in general. I mean, I feel like the comedy that interests me the most is generally comedy with a point of view. Now, of course, nothing's absolute here. I mean, I don't know if you can really identify a point of view or any sort of political or social point of view in somebody like Stephen Wright or even Steve Martin and they're both geniuses, you know. But I tend more towards the stuff that that raises different emotions besides and along with just laughter. I like things that are a little provocative. I like things that make you think. I like things that make you a little bit angry. I like things that play with you, you know, because comedy is a very strange art form. It's the only art form where a good number of people who receive it only want you to be dealing with emotions A through M, only to like positive, upbeat things, whereas no other art form is restricted in such a way. You can have the heaviest dramas that will have moments of comedy in them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But for some reason, people have a very limited attitude or idea about what comedy is or what it should be. And like any other art form, when it's in the shade of gray is when it interests me the most.
So Leno is a joke teller. That's what he calls himself. You know, write joke, tell joke,
yeah.
Get checked.
Actually, the word vulgarian, even Carlin refers to himself as a vulgarian, but he specifically states it's not has nothing to do with language. The word vulgar means of the people. So a vulgarian, in its dictionary definition, is being somebody of the people and speaking of the people, you know, one of you. As opposed to, you know, big superstar diva kind of thing. You know, he's one of the masses. That's what vulgarian means. So actually, really, Leno is, in fact, a vulgarian.
In your conversation with Roseanne, though, she says, comics tell the truth. Now, how true is that statement itself, and how important is it to tell the truth as opposed to just trying to make people laugh?
Well, I think anything that's entertainment has a responsibility to tell some truth. I think, you know, if it's not something that speaks to someone's vision or someone's truth about what it is they're dealing with, then it's nothing more than propaganda, you know, or manipulation. It's merch. It's merchandise. And that's, I want to specify that the people in Satiristas and all the people that I bring onto the green room on Showtime, they're, you know, they're, a lot of people sometimes will hear me talk about comedy in this way and they'll think, you know what, I went to the strip mall comedy club in my neighborhood and I saw the same sort of namby-pamby, same sort of status quo, same sort of obvious hacky kind of material that wasn't about anything that, you know, was sexist, racist, homophobic, whatever. You know, yes, that exists. That's not the kind of comedy we're talking about. So when Roseanne says, you know, comics are truth tellers, she's talking about those who work artfully, those who look at it as an art form and embrace it as such, and embrace it as something more than just a way to make a living. And in that context, she's absolutely right.
Talking with Paul Provenza about his book Satiristas, he also hosts The Green Room on Showtime. We talked before about sensitivity of audiences or people being satirized, whether they're on the right or the left. But also, there's a sensitivity within the comic community. And I want to mention the name Janine Garofalo to you here. I just happened to have seen a new stand-up special of hers the other night on TV, which didn't make me laugh one bit, but that's neither here nor there. She was viciously mocked by Matt and Trey, the South Park guys, in their movie Team America. I mean, viciously mocked by them. Were they out of line?
Well, you know, there's a lot of arguments to that, and Matt and Trey, Matt Stone and Trey Parker, creators of South Park, are also represented in Satiristas, and they talk about, you know, what it is that they do, and Janine talks about it from her personal point. I mean, you know, Janine says if they wanted to mock my point of view, if they wanted to mock the ideas that she had, you know, that she would have no issue with it. But they went after her for sort of personality things and things that are really not substantive, and that's why she really took issue with it. She took issue with it more as a fellow comedian, a fellow comedy artist, than as an individual whose feelings were hurt. Mm-hmm. And I do understand that, you know, but Matt and Trey also have a bigger point. You know, they have a bigger statement to make about celebrities getting involved in politics and all those sorts of things, which really, in Janine's case, is a bit unfair. But, you know, that's what makes comedy interesting.
You also
not everybody agrees on everything. In fact, most comedians, you know, there's a reason that comedians have never had a union, and it's because you cannot get three comedians to agree on anything.
You'll get four opinions.
yeah, that's right, exactly. Yeah, I even say they couldn't even decide on where to put the apostrophe in comedians union.
You also, in the book, talk with Joy Behar, who has her own primetime show now on HLN, and, of course, is part of the cast of characters on The View. And she says that when people come see her in person, they're surprised by what she does on stand-up, because she's not TV Joy, is she?
Well, see, that's one of the reasons why I really wanted to include her in the book, because she's somebody who speaks her mind, doesn't care what people think, it has no problem with conflict or confrontation, and she does all of that in what is generally the most anodyne, sanitized, namby-pamby part of television, which is daytime.
Yep.
And, you know, the fact that she maintains the strength of her character in that context, I thought was really, really fascinating, and it actually makes her quite an innovator, really, if you think about it. I mean, think about daytime television, and think of anybody else who really, truly speaks their mind and doesn't just, you know, try and sell dishwashing liquid. So she's interesting to me very much in that context, and she is very much herself when she does live stand-up, and a lot of people who know her from The View are pretty surprised.
Yes,
pretty
they
surprised
are.
at how polarizing she can be.
Last thing I want to ask you about, in the book, you say that The Graduate and Groundhog Day are two films that really clarified for you the balance between broad comedy and genuine introspection in comedy. Can you clarify that statement for us?
Well, I think that, well, first of all, The Graduate is such a rich and complex movie. I mean, there's so many emotions going on there, and the comedy in it is not jokey comedy. It's the comedy born of the conflict between all those ideas and the pressures around you, especially at that particular age and time. I mean, Dustin Hoffman's character in The Graduate is essentially Holden Caulfield, you know? And so that's a really, really rich piece for me. And when I was young and saw that for the first time, I didn't even think of it as a comedy until I went back and saw it again, and I was like, this is really funny. And so that was something that was confusing to me and opened up to me the idea that, wow, comedy doesn't necessarily have to look like, you know, Carol Burnett's show. And Groundhog Day, interestingly, because Groundhog Day is such a funny movie, I mean, there's no question that that's a comedy. It's so funny, and it's so consistently funny, yet they never go for the laugh, and it's based on a very, very powerful sort of idea, you know, this idea of getting things right and making the same mistakes over and over and trying to learn from them. And that's a massive life lesson, and it's very specific in that movie. So to be as broadly funny as that movie is, but still have such a rich theme is, you know, that was another one that made me think, wow, man, you can even be that hilarious and still be talking about something substantive that's not clear, that's a little intuitive, that's a little bit, it calls for you to do a little work and thought.
Conan O'Brien.
So those two are really, being there is another one that's remarkable in that regard.
Oh, yeah, absolutely right, absolutely. Conan O'Brien, Lily Tomlin, Judd Apatow, Mike Nichols, Craig Ferguson, Richard Lewis, P.J. O'Rourke, Greg Proops, Will Durst, and on and on and on. It's a tremendous list of people that Paul sat down with and talked to, just as he does on his Showtime show, The Green Room. If you're into comedy and you want to hear what these people think about the craft, pick up this terrific volume. It's called Satiristas, Comedians, Contrarians, Raconteurs, and Vulgarians. Paul, I've had a pleasure talking to you.
It's been delightful. Thank you. You've asked among the most insightful questions of anybody I've talked to about the book, so I'm particularly thrilled to talk to you.
Well, you know, I didn't want to start off with a question I'm sure you get all the time, which is, what makes something funny? I didn't want to go there. I'll see you at the Amazing Meeting.
If I knew the answer to that, my friend,
yeah,
I'd be too big to talk to you.
I'll see you at the Amazing Meeting next week in Vegas. Looking forward to it.
Thank you. Looking forward to it here, too.
Paul Provenza. Satiristas is the book. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.